This is KPDO 89.3 FM, serving Pescadero and the South Coast. I'm Catherine Peary. The show is Coastside Conversations, and my guest today is Rick Flores, who is associated with the Arboretum in Santa Cruz. And could you tell us your titles there, Rick?
Yes. Here at the Arboretum, I am Director of Horticulture and Steward of the Amamutsen Relearning Program.
Okay. And the main reason we're talking today is because of your stewardship of the Amamutsen Relearning Program. I happened to meet you over at Pi Ranch, and you guys have had a relationship with Pi Ranch for a while. I was working at their amazing Amamutsen Native Garden. And I've gone, since I met you, I've gone over there again. It is a beautiful spot. And so maybe you could just talk about your relationship with Jared Lawson and Nancy and how that got started and what you're doing over there.
Pi Ranch, Jared and Nancy were really keen several years ago to develop a relationship with the Amamutsen Tribal Band because they wanted to call attention to the indigenous history of the land on which they farm. And so Jared, I believe, met Chairman Lopez at several meetings around that time. And they also reached out to me because of my work as steward of the Amamutsen Relearning Program to learn more. And we connected everybody together and we had some meetings to discuss how, you know, what the collaboration between the Amamutsen and Pi Ranch would look like. And among other things, one of those collaborations was the native plant garden that's there at the beginning of the farm. And Pi Ranch, you know, stops there at all their farm tours to talk about the Amamutsen, the history of the land, and the efforts today of the Amamutsen Tribal Band to relearn, some cultural knowledge that they lost during colonization. Pi Ranch has also been a wonderful partner with the Amamutsen Land Trust. They open up their farm to let the Native Stewardship Corps camp there from time to time. They're also collaborators up at Cascade Ranch, where the Amamutsen have a nursery project to grow native plants to help restore Coroste Valley Cultural Preserve. So Pi Ranch has been a wonderful partner in that endeavor as well.
So Amamutsen are involved in the Coroste tribe somehow, am I mistaken in that?
Well, the Amamutsen, they are the descendants of the tribal groups who were taken to Mission Santa Cruz and Mission San Juan Batista during Spanish colonization of the coast. So each of their family lineages can trace back to an ancestor who was documented at one of those missions. And so many of the Coroste people, we believe, were also taken to Mission Santa Cruz. So today the Amamutsen, represent that area. It's kind of on the border between the Amamutsen and the Muwekma tribe.
Yeah, I just found out about the Muwekma tribe. I just heard about them. So yeah, it's interesting. I read, I went down to see San Juan Batista and I picked up a book on basically on the colonization of the Indians and what happened to them. And it was really kind of a horrible story. And so to recover from that and to know how oppressed they were, how their population was decimated, and how the state, there was state-sponsored, not just oppression, but I mean, they were really...
Yeah, there was space. There was state-sponsored genocide in the 1850s. California, the state of California was actually selling bonds at that time that funded militias and their bullets and rifles to go out and basically murder Native Americans. So there's a very long, tragic, colonial history here on the Central Coast.
Well, and it goes back to the Spaniards, but it continues mm-hmm. with, you know, the people who came, the people who came for the gold and all that.
Yeah.
But one of the things that is current right now and that affects the community here, the Pescadero and South Coast communities, is the practice that the Amamutsin had and other tribes had of managing the land through the use of burning. And it was, you know, you can call it cultural burning, controlled burns, prescribed burns, but it was a very specific practice. And I wonder if you can go into that a little bit. I mean, one of the main things that I've learned since the fires, and one of the reasons that I'm interested in this, is the tribes managed the land for thousands of years in a way that benefited the people and the land. And for so long, we had this practice of never letting anything burn. And then, of course, the result was a catastrophic wildfire that burned down many homes in this area, probably 48 homes in White House Canyon, 20 homes in Gazos Creek area, and 1,200 homes south in the Santa Cruz County area. And so what we're all looking for is the wisdom of the past, the success that they had at what they were doing, and we want to learn from that, right? We want to take advantage of that knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so I think everybody's interested in specifically what were the benefits of that? How was it practiced? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so, benefits were multiple benefits to the use of fire on the landscape. Not only did it reduce fuel loads that prevented kind of catastrophic wildfires, but it also sustained ecosystems. You know, what we know now is that some of our ecosystems here on the Central Coast aren't necessarily natural, and we could talk about that too. Ecosystems such as grasslands and coastal prairies and oak woodlands, had prescribed fire on their landscapes for thousands of years by Native people. And, you know, the fires really kept the landscape open and productive. Mm-hmm. And what we realize now is when you remove fire or other disturbance from the landscape, these ecosystems, such as grasslands or coastal prairies, become quickly invaded by surrounding vegetation, quickly invaded by things like coyote brush, conifers like Douglas fir trees, poison oak, coffee berry, and things like that. And they invade to such extent that over time, you actually lose those grasslands. And so Native people knew this. They knew about plant succession. And so they would burn to keep the coastal prairies open and productive. The same things can happen in our oak woodlands. If Douglas fir trees or other conifers invade oak woodlands, once they get taller than the oaks, they shade out the oaks, and the oaks will slowly die from that. So for the same reason, they were burning oak woodlands too, to keep them open and productive and to keep these other vegetation types from encroaching on the desired, vegetation type of the coastal prairies and oak woodlands.
So one of the things that I read, and I've listened to a couple of videos about this, is there was a very specific approach where, for example, let's say that you had a forest that was 10,000 acres, maybe, and you would burn, or the tribe would burn, maybe 1/7 of it in a year, and then the next 1/7 in the next year. And by doing this in rotation, they were not just keeping the land open and productive, but they were actually providing tools and food and seeds for themselves. Mm-hmm. That was really surprising to me that every year they knew exactly what was going to come out of that fire. And so if something had been burned for 1 year, they'd get certain kinds of seeds. If something had been burned for 2 years, they could get something that they could use for weaving baskets, that sort of thing. And I'm wondering if you know of resources for that, if you know of books on that, or have you learned more about that?
So it is true that in different years after, you know, those kind of rotational fires were set, different cultural resources came about. One of the main researchers for this work is a woman named Kat Anderson, who wrote a really wonderful book called Tending the Wild, which I highly recommend. But she's also done some other work and publications, too, that talk about these different types of resources that come about in different years after a fire. So her work is really well known and is something people are able to find as well.
Can you tell me how you spell her name? Is it Kat, like C-A-T, and then Anderson, S-O-N? Do you know?
It's Kat with a K.
Okay.
And Anderson, I'm not sure if it's with an O or an N. I can look that up really quick.
Well, all right. Well, that's wonderful. We want to know these things. I think all of us are looking at everything we can to mitigate disaster, but also help the land become productive and restore, as you say, grasslands, coastal prairies, oak woodlands, the native habitat that we have had in the past. I did an interview with Chelsea Casey, and she is a scientist, soil scientist, and she was talking about all the amazing flora and fauna, what comes out of a fire. Suddenly you have all these, what she calls fire followers, things that grow once the fire has come along. Mm-hmm. And that was amazing to me. So the fire is necessary for so much of what grows here, not just, you know, of course, we know that the redwood trees, you know, they're not going to propagate unless there is fire, right? Well, evidently, there's a whole bunch of annuals that come back, a little annual, beautiful, sunny flowers that come back as well. I think at this point, we're all fascinated by, we never knew that there was such a benefit to fires.
Well, a lot of our native plants respond to fire, and our fire followers or fires help, you know, seeds germinate. I would like to say, though, that, you know, there's different kinds of fires, obviously. You know, native indigenous fires were low intensity, slow moving fires through the landscape because they were burning, you know, regularly. There wasn't a lot of fuel on the landscape. And so when they would set fires, from, you know, the late fall through early spring, when the weather was cool, when the ground was damp. And so you would get these low intensity, slow moving fires that would just kind of creep through a landscape and then ultimately just burn themselves out because they would hit a patch of land that was, you know, maybe burnt a year or two earlier. And there just wasn't enough fuel to carry it forward. This is in contrast to, you know, these kind of high intensity, catastrophic wildfires that we see today where, you know, they're hot, they're in the tree canopies. And things like that. That is not what indigenous burning was. It was methodical, low intensity. And the reason they burned, you know, when you're speaking about the annuals that come back, that's why they would burn to keep coastal prairies open. A lot of our native annual species occur in grasslands. Mm-hmm. And what we know now is that native people in this area were eating a lot of grassland seed foods. They were harvesting the seeds of annual wildflowers, the seeds of grasses, and other plants that was a major food source for them. So that gave them reason to keep the coastal prairies open and productive, is because of the amount of cultural resources that they were able to harvest from them.
Seeds and of flowers and of certain, I guess, grasses were part of their regular diet. This was something they depended on.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And of course, there's berries and all kinds of other things. That
yeah. Berries and nuts were also a part of the diet. And, you know, of course, you know, my work is with terrestrial plants and stuff, but, you know, the ocean is right here with us, and shellfish and seaweed and, you know, salmon were all part of the diet as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have been a docent at Año Nuevo for a long time. I haven't been back since the pandemic yet, but yeah, the middens that we found there were just full of shells from the summer camps out there of the, I believe, Coroste Indians. And they ate literally mounds and mounds of shellfish. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. Over time, that was their summer camp. And so it was a very varied diet. So what they were doing in part was a kind of farming, right? It's a land stewardship where you manage the forest through fire, low intensity, continuous fire. And there's, you know, a method to it. So it was providing them with resources, not just for food, as I understand it, but also, you know, like basket weaving or the materials that they needed for clothing or sewing or I don't know if they called them canoes, but, you know, whatever they used, they were using everything out here, the tules and all that.
Oh, yeah, they were using hundreds of plants within their tribal territories for textiles, for foods, for medicines, for constructions, for animal traps, for basketry, you know, mm-hmm. you name it. Native people in this area, they were, kind of a plant-based culture. Everything yeah. that they made came from plants.
Right. Unlike, you know, the people who were doing everything with furs. So that's,
I would like to say, though, that farming was not happening in this area, prior to contact by Native people. And there's a distinction there. They were cultivating plants through their sophisticated management practices and the use of fire, but they were not domesticating plants. And that's the difference between kind of this place-based stewardship and farming as we think of it today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So they weren't doing the thing where some very many North American tribes were actually like growing corn and beans and squash together and things like that.
No, that was not happening here on the Central Coast. It was more of the use of fire to, you know, sustain grasslands and encourage seed germination and plant growth and stuff like that.
Now, I understand, though, that it did also help them to manage herds of elk and deer. In other words, the openness of the mm-hmm. land allowed the grazing that was needed for the elk population and the deer as well.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, the practices of fire created this open kind of pasture land for all the herbivores. Mm-hmm. And stuff. And what you were referring to a little earlier about the different types of resources that come about after fire, you know, it's not just resources for human beings, but it's resources for the whole community of life. And after a fire, you know, all the native grasses resprout. Those new sprouts are often very succulent and some of the favorite for herbivores. So the practices of fire not only, you know, took care of people, it took care of plants and animals as well.
You know, that's the thing I've been reading up a lot on different cultures, different native cultures, and it is all about the whole community, meaning, you know, whatever else was here. And at the time, there were some grizzly bears, there were mountain lions, there were all these different animals, mm-hmm. and the deer and the elk and things that we just don't see anymore. And everything in abundance. And so, and they, my understanding, and maybe you know about this as well, is they basically saw the animals as, in a sense, givers of life. In other words, they had to show their gratitude to, you know, God and the animals in order to partake in, say, sacrificing an animal for their own sustenance.
Well, I believe that, you know, they saw themselves as an integral part of the natural world, not separate from it. You know, like we see today, we do today, and you know, and that speaks to another reason for fire too, is that you know, it was a form of protection as well. Like it created more open spaces and less spaces for predators and stuff like that to hide in. So if you could imagine being here at the time when the grizzly bears were here, you would definitely want to know where they were in relation to your to your village site. And you know, when you burn, you can, you know, you burn all the tall grasses and shrubbery down, and you know, you can see farther.
No, really. I mean, it's so true. It's a scary thought to be going through a deep forest and be accosted by a grizzly. I mean, that would be a very frightening experience. Yeah. And you do see I don't know if this was true for the Almamutsin, but you see the Ohlones used a similar practice. And they also, you know, made canoes out of tules and things like that so that they could go through the marshes and the wider creeks so that they could avoid so that they could get the fish, but also so that they could avoid the predators on land, is my understanding. It was a fast highway to someplace else. So the Almamutsin they're retracing their heritage back to people who lived in this area hundreds of years ago. How long were the Almamutsin here? Do you know?
Well, if you speak with the Almamutsin, they would say they've been here forever. Mm-hmm. You know, most indigenous people say that. Mm-hmm. If you look at the archaeological records, what we know now, and you know, this is always kind of changing with, you know, research that goes on, but I believe the earliest human remains were found on the Channel Islands, and it dated back to something like 14,000 years ago, 15,000 mm-hmm. years ago.
Yeah.
So a long
and to
long
and to have time. A sustained, you know, to be able to sustain the land, to live productively on that land for so many thousands of years. What a contrast to the way we live. You know, we have so much to learn, but I think we're waking up to that. You know, I really do. I think we're waking up to it and looking forward to learning to, you know, to appreciate and to absorb what their practices were and to try to emulate them to the extent that we can. And I think that's true for Cal Fire. That's true for some of the large landowners like, Tomcat Ranch and Pie Ranch and some other large landowners. So people really want to understand this, want to get some guidance on it. And I wonder if there's something coming down the pike that will provide that. Is there some program that's being designed, some teaching tools or anything like that?
Well, one thing the Almamutsin Land Trust did after the fires is they had a fire symposium, and there's a video of it you can find on their website, where a lot of fire experts, Scott Stevens from UC Berkeley, Kent Lightfoot from UC Berkeley, Rob Kutherl also from UC Berkeley, all talked about the role of fire in our landscape and how it could be beneficial for us to use today. Within the Almamutsin Land Trust, one of their desires is to have their own fire crew one day, and they are working towards that so that they could, you know, start setting their own prescribed fires and assist local landowners with protecting their property and fire prevention and stuff like that too. So those things are in the works. As you can imagine, it takes a lot of time and resources to get something like that up and running.
Sure.
But that's what they're moving towards today.
And in our environment, our legal environment, it's so complex. I was speaking to Sarah Collimer, who's a Cal Fire vegetation management person, and the permits involved with a prescribed burn are unbelievable. And then all the agencies that you have to be involved with and notify and have applications with. So yeah, it's not just, you know, getting to the point where we embrace this and understand its value, but that we can accommodate it legally. I mean, we're such a regulated society, and being able to kind of mesh those two parts, you know, this cultural knowledge and then all these laws and regulations, that by itself is going to take a long time.
Well, I think also, you know, today our landscape is very different, unfortunately. You know, it's not just native plants anymore. We have a lot of introduced plants, introduced exotic weeds. Which makes fire on the landscape more complicated, because unfortunately, you know, exotic grasses, exotic weeds also respond to fire as well. Mm-hmm. When you burn, you know, you're basically creating bare ground, which provides a good opportunity for plants to colonize that bare ground. And we have a lot of vigorous exotics.
Are you thinking pampas grass and things like that?
You know, pampas grass, the weedy brome grasses, mm-hmm. You know, Scotch broom, French broom, you know, vinca. Right. Like, there's a lot of bad weeds mm-hmm. here on the Central Coast that unfortunately also will respond to fire as well. Mm-hmm. So today there needs to be like kind of a multiple pronged approach, I think, to fire and, you know, fire and also, you know, monitoring and weed removal and stuff like that, you know, to make it successful.
I think that what people are concentrating on right now is pure fuel reduction. That's all they can think about. How do we get some of the debris out of here so that we don't have this fire again right now? And so getting a bigger plan, I think that's something maybe the county parks people are thinking about. It's something that San Mateo Resource Conservation District is thinking about. It's something that Peninsula Open Space is thinking about. Those are the people who might have the resources to create a plan. I don't know if the Amamutsen Trust Land Trust is working with those groups or not.
The Amamutsen Land Trust works with a lot of environmental organizations in the area. You know, they do have a relationship with Mid Peninsula Regional Open Space District, with California State Parks, you know, with the Bureau of Land Management for the management of the new national monument, Chitone Coast Dairies. So the Amamutsen have partnered with a lot of, you know, environmental groups and land holding agencies in this area.
Well, that's awesome. And that's great.
Yeah. So fuel, you know, I know fuel reductions at the forefront of everybody's mind, and it's something that definitely needs to be done. You know, but native burning, indigenous burning, was more than just fuel reduction. It was also about natural resource management as well.
Right. You right. know. Well, that's what we need to get to. You know, people are doing the stopgap measures right now, but it seems as though everybody's understanding that the long-term approach, which is this regular kind of burning that was being done and using the resources that became available because of it, that's more of the goal, right? That's what we would like. But as you say, there's so much to do to get us back to a point where we don't have all these invasive species like pampas grass and all the brooms and vinca and things like that. So I don't know. I don't know how you do it. It's a lot.
It's a big project. You know, I've been fortunate to be involved in two prescribed burns with the Amamutsen. And before each burn, you know, Cal Fire will actually, and they've been, you know, small acreage burns. And before you burn, you know, Cal Fire and others will get in there and actually do a bit of fuel reduction first, before they even set the fire. So, you know, I remember when the CZU Lightning Complex first started, Cal Fire was having these morning, you know, news briefings. And one of the fire captains said at one of these briefings that they were battling the fire in an area that had 3 feet of leaf litter.
Oh, wow.
And so that's the type of fuel loads we're talking about right now in our mountains. I mean, it's more than just like, you know, dead branches on the ground and stuff like that. It's also this pile of leaf litter.
Which raises the fuel ladder. They call it a fuel ladder. If you can get that down to the ground, you're really reducing the intensity or even the possibility of fire. But if you start at 3 feet and then you move to the next bush and it goes up a tree, I mean, you're doomed. So yeah, I mean, right above me, I'm in Butte No Canyon, and the fire came from the south, and consequently, because the wind shifted, we had almost no fire here. It was a blessing. But if it had gone over the creek and gone up the hill above me, there's again like 3 feet of oak leaves waiting to burn. It's and manzanita, old manzanita, just dried up and littering the sides of the mountains. So it's scary. Yeah. It's scary to think that we still have so much to do in terms of just fuel reduction right now, which is what people are thinking about. But long term, you know, if we could get to a point of doing these prescribed burns in small acres and concentrating on those and then expanding them, I think it's a step by step kind of phased approach we could actually manage. So you said you were involved with two prescribed burns and that CAL FIRE had done some of the vegetation management. So what is the story there? I mean, how long did it take to arrange? How long did it take to prepare for? And then how big were these prescribed burns?
Well, I've been involved in two prescribed burns. One was at Pinnacles National Park back in 2011, I believe. The other one was right up the road from UCSC here at San Vicente Redwoods. That was in collaboration with the Semper Virens Fund and CAL FIRE. They were small acreage burns, no more than maybe 2 to 4 acres. But yeah, CAL FIRE and others would first, you know, do a bit of fuel reduction within the burn areas first before they set fires. And then, you know, they're very scientific about it. When to set fire, you know, the humidity has to be right in the air, you know, relatively no breezes or wind. And so it's not like you can say, okay, this is the day we're going to, you know, have a prescribed fire. It's more like we hope to have the prescribed fire this day, but we got to watch the weather and make sure it's, you know, an appropriate day to burn based on the weather.
Yeah, I interviewed Sarah Collimer, who is a CAL FIRE vegetation management person who is involved with Tomcat Ranch's prescribed burns. And she told me the whole story as far as she was out there. I don't know what she was using to try to crush some of the coyote bush, but she was trying to get that down so that it would be kind of dead and ready to burn. And then she told me all the different, like the air quality control regulations and what you're saying, which you can't have a breeze. It has to be, you know, just the perfect conditions. It's like, wow, how do you ever decide? How do you ever get the go ahead on that? It sounds very complicated. Well, but they do, I guess.
The professionals in CAL FIRE are the ones that give the go ahead.
Yeah, that's what's happening.
They've been burning for, you know, years or even decades around here. So
yeah, and they have a huge budget this coming year, something like $84 million or more for just making fire breaks, reducing fuel, and establishing these prescribed burns. So everybody's understanding at this point that we can't continue with the policy of no fire. That really didn't work. And now we're trying to achieve what was a wonderful balanced approach that the Amamutes and another tribes were working with. And it's just going to take some time to get there. There's so many steps in between where we are now and where we need to be. but that's where we need their guidance. You know, we need their help.
So. You know, part of the problem is, you know, we have this idea of wilderness in this country that was brought to us by, you know, people like John Muir, and stuff like that. This idea that humans are separated from the so-called wilderness, and that it's God's creation. And, you know, if you look at the Wilderness Act, it says that a wilderness is a place that is untrammeled by man, you know, where man is just a visitor that, you know, leaves no trace or anything, you know, and that definition is a complete erasure of indigenous history on the landscape. Mm-hmm. We know Native people were not mere visitors. We know that they were stewarding and managing the land mm-hmm. for thousands of years, and these stewardship practices changed the composition of plant communities over time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just think a lot of people still hold on to these ideas of this pristine wilderness. That is
it's definitely going away, Rick. I will say that. I mean,
Central Coast it is. Yeah.
Well, not just on the Central Coast, but I'm seeing more and more. Look at Yellowstone. I mean, Yellowstone was a wake up call for a lot of people. It was like, oh my God, what have we allowed to take place? Right. And then from there, there's a whole lot of people who've learned that no, we've got to change our ways. And the Native Americans knew what they were doing. And we have to appreciate that and learn from it. And that I think is what I'm hearing more and more, is that people really want that guidance. They really want to understand what was involved. They really want to get to that point. So I get what you're saying. And I've heard many people quote, you know, that same wilderness definition as something that is now, it was a beautiful thought. And it made, you know, and it made the land sacrosanct. You couldn't touch it, and when I first moved here, Post definitely had that approach. They have done a 180 on that. And so have many other environmental groups. So I think the world is changing, Rick. I think it is.
I think so too. I mean, a lot of wonderful things are happening here on the Central Coast. I just don't know how much it's happening, you know, around the rest of the country. Or,
well, you know what they say, that matter. They say that California is the future for the rest of the country. We start it, and then they follow eventually. And I hope it's true. Honestly, I do sort of believe that if we make this work, if we can actually manage the forests as they were, you know, a few hundred years ago, and for the thousands of years before that, I think everybody else is going to wake up to it. But I do know that it's happening in other places. I do know that the Native American tribes in other places are helping to make it happen.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's not just because the Westerners are waking up. It's because the Native tribes are asserting themselves and saying, you know, this is not the way it's done, right? We can do a better job. So, and people are also learning how, you know, the idea that man is a partner, and that man is a part of the ecosystem, and he has to start behaving with respect for the whole balance, or we have what the crisis that we're in, right? Not just in terms of fires, but climate in general, right? So,
yeah.
It's coming, Rick, and you're right in this really great place.
It is refreshing that it's all starting to happen, you know. But it's going to take some time, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely. All right, well, I've really enjoyed this conversation. This was awesome. Thank you so much for your knowledge and also just what you do. I mean, it was a pleasure working with you over at Pi Ranch, and you were right down in there picking up the weeds and pruning things like everybody else. And it was great to meet you and to work with you. This is Coastside Conversations. My guest has been Rick Flores, the steward of the Amamutsun Relearning Program. This is Coastside Conversations at 89.3 FM, serving Pescadero and the South Coast. And we will talk to you later.